Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. It's a pleasure to welcome into the studio somebody who once occupied this chair on Sunday nights, Paul Collins. Paul, hi.
Hello, John.
Thanks for being here, and the reason we've asked you in tonight is to have a look at Pope Francis. Just in the last week, he's been an extraordinarily busy figure, as he has since he first sat in the papal chair. And this week, two letters that have had significance around the world, one not unsurprising on the sex abuse issue, and the other on Oscar Romero, the martyred priest who has been declared as a bishop, a martyr of the church by the Pope. Now, we'll go to the political implications of that a little later, but let's talk first about the sex abuse scandal and what the Pope's statement this week adds to pressure within the church, how this adds to pressure within the church.
John, I think that the key thing to understand here is not so much that someone like Cardinal Sean O'Malley, the Archbishop of Boston, no, he's not an Irishman, he's an American, O'Malley is on this committee that the Pope has set up with regard to the issue of sex abuse. Now, there has been quite a bit of criticism of Francis that he's done nothing about it, that there's been a bit of window dressing, that he invited some sexual abuse victims to come to the Vatican and to attend Mass. But people say it's all talk and no action. Now, I think action is right on the horizon now, and I think the reason for that is not so much O'Malley, not so much the criticism that he's copped as a result of not doing anything. It comes from the way in which he operates as Pope, and that is an issue has got through to him personally. And how it's got through to him is that there have been a number of bad sexual abuse cases in Latin American countries, including in his own Argentina and also in Chile and Brazil. But what happened was that there has been a very bad case and a very recent one between 2004 and 2007 in Spain, in Granada in Spain, where 10 priests and two Catholic lay workers have been accused of sexually abusing a number of children, of boys, altar boys mainly. What happened was that one of those, who's now 25, one of the victims, who's now 25, wrote to Francis and said what had happened to him. And Francis is a great one for picking up the phone and actually talking to people unexpectedly. And he called this guy, and he's got the story. And see, that's the way to the heart of this papacy, to understand that this is a man who deals directly with in person-to-person relationship. And I think that's how the sexual abuse issue has come to the fore. It's not so much pressure from outside, pressure from, you know, cardinals or pressure groups or whoever. It's when he encounters it personally. And I think that this personal encounter, which only occurred about less than a month ago, it was remarked on passingly in the media. He's now sent out a letter to all bishops and reminded them of their duty to stamp out sexual abuse of children. And he's told them also, forget the fear of scandal. No more cover-ups. The time has come to face the music. And so this committee that he has set up, I think, is now going to be given the power to really do something about this issue. The Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors, they always love pretentious titles in the Vatican, that's been given a brief now to drive reform on this issue. And I think that it will. If you have a look at who's on it, it's a reasonably impressive group of people.
Including one Australian.
Yes, it does. And I think also a New Zealander, actually, John. And, of course, it's distinguished by the name of a lady whose name is Marie Collins. So she's obviously an important person with such a new fine surname. I was also quite amused to see that one of the members of it is a gentleman named Claudio Papale, an Italian canon lawyer. Whether he is papabile, of course, is another matter. So it's an international committee, and it's also a powerful committee. And I do think it signals a determination on France's part to do something about this.
What does this do with the material that was canvassed last year in the book Potiphar's Wife, which suggested that there is still in existence a protocol relating to the way bishops and clergy should handle issues of sexual abuse, and that is they should report them initially internally and not go necessarily to the civil authorities. Is this in conflict with that? Did this usurp that? Or is that whole thing a bit of a sort of storm in a teacup?
Well, my reading of this particular letter of Pope Francis is that, and it's, I think, very clear now that there's no excuse on the part of bishops. They can't hide behind that protocol, the title of which is Crimen Solicitudinis, I think my Latin's right there. They can't hide behind that. And now they are, I mean, they are simply expected to go to the police. Certainly that would be true here in Australia, but I think now it would be taken on right across the world, except, of course, you see, and I mean, this is the interesting thing. I've been kind of interested in the Royal Commission looking into the yeshiva colleges just last week. They've been doing it. And you can understand that Jews did not want to, during persecution, I mean, they were persecuted for so long in Europe. You would understand that they didn't want to hand over members to the civil authorities because it would just give another stick to the community to beat the Jewish community with. So I think that, and part of, I think, the background of this kind of church's protection mechanism lies in that kind of perception of persecution.
The fear of civil persecution.
Fear of civil persecution. Yes. I mean, in to some extent, when you look back into the 19th century, when as Potiphar's Wife, the book shows, this really came into being. You can see there was the Kulturkampf in Germany, the kind of attack on Catholicism by Bismarck in Germany. There were the anti-clerical laws in France, and certainly the seizing of the papal states in Italy and the kind of papacy's reaction to that after 1870. You've got all of that, of course. It's a perception of persecution rather than a real persecution. But I think those days are gone. I think it's clear that the church is going to have to absolutely come clean on this.
Now, there's another issue that brought Francis to public attention this week, and that is his declaration about Archbishop Oscar Romero. Now, for people who don't recall the story of Oscar Romero standing up for the rights of the poor and dispossessed, as he perceived them, in his cathedral, and gunned down by political opponents, just bring this into context for us.
Well, you've got to remember that this is in the heyday of the Reagan years, the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, the revolt against the right-wing governments and American commercial interests, and that people might recall the Iran-Contra affair, and the famous Colonel Oliver North. So it's in that period. It's in the period when the US government was pouring aid into what was essentially a murderous government in Nicaragua, a right-wing government, and in its attempts to stamp out the Sandinista revolution, which was, of course, Marxist and left-wing. Archbishop Oscar Romero was Archbishop of El Salvador, and the country was also facing a revolution. So the right-wing government actually had him shot while celebrating mass in a hospital. So in many ways, most people, I suppose, who were inclined to the left would have revered Oscar Romero as a martyr. He'd started off as a quite conservative man, but his experience of ministry and his experience of the poor and of the murderous government that he had to deal with brought him right around to a far more social justice orientation. So Romero was shot. Now, just not long after that, I think 2 years after that, the well-known Polish priest, Jerzy Popieluszko, please correct my pronunciation on that Polish name, he was also murdered by the secret police of the communist government in Poland. He was immediately recognised as a martyr, as he was, whereas Romero was not by the Vatican. And, of course, the reason here is the kind of anti-communist preoccupation that the Vatican tended to have under John Paul II, the fear that John Paul II had of so-called liberation theology, and the fear that Ratzinger, who was the Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who was the head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, had. They were totally opposed to communism and Marxism infiltrating liberation theology in Latin America. And so the cause of Romero as a martyr just simply never advanced in the very strange organization called the Congregation for the Causes of Saints, whose offices are just around the corner from the Vatican Press Office. I often walk past the office when I'm in Rome. That this strange organization made sure that Romero, under both the Wojtyła and Ratzinger papacies, was excluded from consideration.
That would help explain some of the headlines appearing in US magazines about this, is that this is a slap to the American right. And you say, oh, hang on, how do you read the sort of martyrdom or recognition of the martyrdom of a El Salvadorian bishop as a slap to the American right? But that puts it in some context. Does it have relevance for the current debate in the United States?
Well, I would have thought that it does. I would have thought a lot of things that Pope Francis has said, including a lot of things in his apostolic constitution, Evangelii Gaudium. He said a lot of things that would have to be very offensive to the neocon Catholics in the United States, and there are many, many of them. I mean, you only have to look at the Republican Party. The Speaker of the House of Representatives, probably the most powerful Republican politically at any rate, is of course a Catholic, a practicing Catholic. And so I think what this Pope is doing is destabilizing that kind of righteousness that you tend to see it in the left as well as in the right, but you certainly see it in the right and you certainly see it among the convinced ideologues of the neoconservative side. And, Romero is certainly not their hero. And their hero does tend to be John Paul II. I think what's happening is that their position is, they're being forced into a position where perhaps they might have to re-examine their ideology.
And this goes to the heart of the way this Pope is interpreting Catholic social teaching.
Absolutely. I mean, But in a way, to give them their due, John Paul II and Ratzinger, Pope Benedict XVI, very much in the mainstream Catholic social teaching, going back to Pope Leo XIII, who died in 1903. It's not something new, but it's been something that, if you like, the ideologues of the right, who believe, in the creed of neoconservatism, particularly neo-rationalist economics. These people's, in my view, the position of these people has been incompatible with mainstream and established Catholic teaching all along. But what I think Francis is doing is, because he's so upfront, he is actually forcing them into the position where they have to ask themselves whether this line of thought, and I would certainly say that quite a number of people in the Liberal Party and on the right here in Australia, Catholics in the Liberal Party and on the right, would also have to ask themselves these questions. It's not confined to the United States. It's just that Australian neocons tend to be a little more modest than the American ones, and just as the left has to ask itself a lot of questions, I think so does the right.
Well, it raises the question, the other great sort of moral ethical issue that this Pope has touched on, and previous popes, is that the environment. Because that's the next big picture item, isn't it?
That's the next one, John, to upset the right. He's made it quite clear that he's going to bring out an encyclical and that he hopes to bring it out before the big conference in Paris, which it's later in the year. I can't remember exactly which month it's in. I think October, but I'm not sure. It is expected that he will bring out an encyclical on the environment. Now, to their credit, Benedict XVI particularly, and John Paul II much less so, have both spoken about the environment, but it always remained, if you like, a theoretical issue for them. What I think this bloke is going to have to do is he's going to have to move beyond theory and face up to some very hard issues. I wrote an article on this very thing in Eureka Street about 10 days ago, the Jesuit Online daily periodical. I think that he won't quite tackle the really tough issues. And I think the two really tough issues are the issue of population, which of course touches on the contraception question, and the issue of the primacy of the human. What I suppose those of us who are critical of an overemphasis on the primacy of the human, what we would call anthropocentrism, which is that the whole meaning of the universe is kind of exhausted in us. Well, all I can say is that that is hubris beyond all get out, but I don't know that he will tackle that. But what he is clearly going to do is he's clearly going to talk about global warming. He's clearly going to talk about the whole issue of the human causation of global warming. The whole question of carbon is going to be there. I don't think that he will even try to sidestep that. I think that will be right on the agenda. And again, for people I just find this discussion skeptics and believers. I'm not a believer in climate change. I actually know it happens. It's not belief. It's scientific fact. And if they don't think it's fact, I just find this discussion absurd, as do most scientists I know.
Well, there's one other issue that the Pope has signalled, which perhaps does give comfort to those who want to think of the Church as centred on human values, and that's the Synod on the Family, because that's going into a second phase this year.
Well, yeah, and if just to say one other thing about, if I can just backtrack one for one sec, just one other thing on the environment issue is, of course, that the social justice and environment can at times get into conflict. One of his advisors in drawing up this encyclical is the Brazilian theologian Leonardo Boff. And Boff has been one of those who has really tried to tackle the question of the reconciliation of environmental issues with social justice issues, and I think that's a key issue. I think the Synod on the Family, to come back to your question, the Synod on the Family in a way again shows that Pope Francis is a shrewd manager of business. As a number of people have already pointed out, and I'm just repeating what they're saying, if he'd chosen to have a synod on what the Catholic Church calls collegiality, that is, all the bishops sharing in the government of the church, all of the laity, people like me would have got excited, but all of the sensible people, that's 99% of Catholics, would have just shrugged their shoulders and said, who cares? Or if he'd decided to talk about, the role of the papacy or some other thing. But what he's done is he's chosen something that affects everybody. That's the family. It's essentially about human relationships. And in that way, he has created a topic that people are interested in. Now, most of the activist Catholics that I know in Australia are utterly frustrated by the processes that the Vatican has set up in order for them to be able to feed in some response. For instance, the questionnaire came out in late January, and the responses to this questionnaire were supposed to be in by early March. The questionnaire, as it stood, it was called Lineamenta. It came out in a kind of a form of statements and questions that followed, and it's about a 60-page document, and it's incomprehensible unless you're a trained theologian. And so people are just utterly frustrated with it. A number of Catholic activist groups in Australia have written to the two bishops that the Australian Catholic Bishops Conference have elected to go to the synod. That's Archbishop Mark Coleridge of Brisbane and Bishop Eugene Hurley of Darwin. Now, I know for a fact that they have received an answer from Bishop Hurley. It's a very polite answer. I've actually seen the letter, a very polite answer, but non-committal. And they have then followed that up by asking to have a talk to Hurley, to meet with him. Coleridge hasn't even answered the letter, so I leave people to make their own judgments about that. I mean, this is a church, according to Pope Francis, and this is a topic, according to Pope Francis, which involves all Catholics. And, John, as you know, in the ABC we had a statutory obligation, in the old days at any rate, to answer letters within a calendar month. Well, a calendar month has passed, and there's certainly been no response from that to this point, at any rate, from Archbishop Coleridge. So it's a bit difficult when you're trying to dialogue with the bishops who are going to represent you at the synod.
So it is something to keep a close eye on.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And look, John Allen, the American Vatican specialist, had an article a couple of days ago, on the kind of group of bishops who are going to the synod, who have been elected by their own conferences, bishops' conferences. He says that they're a very conservative group. I'm kind of not so sure about that. I mean, I wouldn't tag either Archbishop Coleridge or Bishop Hurley as, you know, kind of ideological conservatives. They're both quite middle of the road. And one of the interesting things just on that is in New Zealand, the recently elected cardinal, the Archbishop of Wellington, John Dew, was not elected by the New Zealand bishops, and there's only, I think, six or seven of them. He wasn't elected to go to represent New Zealand. I wouldn't be surprised if the Pope appointed him. See, the Pope can appoint people. So, look, I'm cautiously optimistic that there will be some movement on communion for remarried divorced Catholics, that I think there will be some real movement on the welcoming of gay people into the church. Just exactly what form that will take is hard to define. And we certainly have to say that the opposition to both of those will largely come from the African bishops, who play this game that this is all part of African culture and so on and so forth. Well, you know, believe it or not, African bishops, when Europe was converted, they had to adapt some of their cultural practices to the Christian faith. And perhaps the Africans have not quite learnt that yet.
Well, we shall see. This and much more to follow. Paul Collins, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us again on Sunday night.
Thanks very much, John.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.